So in a different shir, I spoke about why the boundaries of Eretz Yisrael were so dramatically delayed and severed from their natural location in the beginning of Pinchas. The beginning of Pinchas has the allocation mechanism established, the goral. The beginning of Pinchas has the population that would inherit lands counted and tallied over 20, the second counting, second census. Beginning of Pinchas has the laws of inheritance. Who inherits land from people who decease? So everything is really all set up. Now you'd expect the boundaries, and I talked about the fact that building a country and building a people isn't just about how much land you have. It's about a large, multifaceted project, which includes land, and in some degrees, since the land is obviously handed to us by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, right? It's obviously our presence here in Eretz Yisrael is not exactly welcomed by too many people in our neighborhood, so it's a supernatural presence that HaKadosh Baruch Hu determines, the first Rashi in the Torah. So how are we doing in society building? We can't just develop a procedure to procure land. It has to also be holistic. It has to be organic, a process of improving the communities we live in, the identities we live, the behavior we display, and then land is both a product as well as a catalyst for that. But there's a more specific reason that the boundaries of Eretz Yisrael, the final boundaries or the final list that we've the long awaited for a list. We've heard a lot about Zevas Chalav U'Dvash. We've heard a lot about this country, but where is it? What are the coordinates? You can't punch into ways. I want to go to Zevat Chalav U'Dvash. You can't describe a location just by its characteristics and its features. You got to know where it is, an address. So here are the addresses in Parshas Maaseh. And yet they are incorporated after the list of all these no-name places in the desert, all these Elam Aseh B'nei Yisrael Shal Yotzim 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 Yotzim. And Rashi primarily addresses the inclusion of these Masos in general, famous Rashi. But it seems that there's a message in the juxtaposition of Maaseh B'nei Yisrael with the boundaries of Eretz Yisrael. And that is that you only get to Eretz Yisrael through the Masos. And the acquisition of Eretz Yisrael, although it may not seem that way on paper, is very much a product of the Masos and the travels and the struggles of the previous generation who aren't here. They've been buried in anonymous graves in the desert. They've been literally swept away by the sands of time, in the unmarked graves. We don't even know where they're buried. And obviously there's a moral message here. You want to pay attention to people who suffered and struggled during more difficult periods, and even when you experience times of triumph and salvation. And you know that I remember my eighth child, his name is Yosef, but the middle name is Nehemiah, and I was at the grave of my Zaidi, and for the first time really, I go to my Zaidi's grave at least once a year, I realized that his grandfather, would be my great-great-grandfather, was named Nehemiah and died in the Holocaust and really didn't have anyone named after him. So I included the name Nehemiah as my son, my eighth child, my fourth son's middle name, Yosef Nehemiah. And I felt very, very gratified about naming my son after the son I not only never met, but I never even heard. So talking about six generations earlier from me, one, two, four or five generations earlier, five from my son. And those stories about him, but someone I've never met, hope to meet him one day. But there's something more than that, and it's being able to bridge between life in Israel and life pre-Israel. And it's extremely, extremely pivotal in today's world, in today's conversation. It's really a juxtaposition which didn't really have that much relevance, sadly, for thousands of years when we were not yet in Israel. Historical relevance, obviously, in other messages. In today's modern Israeli discourse, it's really a very pivotal issue. The most extreme form of it, I'll paint the extreme version of it, and then we'll be able to try to itemize lesser forms. The most extreme version is a lot of secular Jews, for example, who look at any event or any experience pre-1948 as an embarrassment, as a tragedy, as a nightmare, as meaningless, as purposeless, and then Jews were redeemed, the new Jew, the brave Jew, the courageous Jew, the mighty Jew, the... There's no historical perspective. There's no recognition that our galus was a punishment as well as a kapara for what happened in the Beis HaMikdash. There's certainly less interest in the Beis HaMikdash as this seminal period of Kedusha and Shechina, which we are striving to reestablish and renovate. It's a culturally important moment because it was the previous Jewish dynasty and Jewish empire. But and there's a real dichotomy. Anything before 1948 is meaningless or shameful. And anything post-1948 is redeemed, triumphant, and gratifying. I don't think most religious Jews live that way. I think perhaps some Haredi Jews. This is obviously, I don't live in a Haredi mindset, so it's harder for me to iterate their mindset. But someone say anything post-1948 is also meaningless so far. It's just a continuation, and we're just still living in the pre-messianic stage, or in the basically Gala stage, until we have Malchus Beis David or Mashiach. We may be physically living in the land of Israel, but it doesn't connote any shift. Part of the challenge for religious Zionist Jews is to, on the one hand, recognize the shift of 1948, but not at the expense of pre-1948, not at the expense of the Masos, not at the expense of all the Jews who lived in different locations and who were heroic and who maintained Jewish identity and protected our deed. Without their heroism in Poland and in Russia and in Spain and in England and in Siberia and in Yemen and in Iraq and in Syria and literally almost every Masos, every location across the globe, protecting our halacha, protecting Malchus Shemayim in this world. There are other less extreme, less glaring manifestations of this. There's something called Torah Eretz Yisraelis, which a lot of people, and it's an attempt to, again, I'm not as familiar with it, I want to articulate something that I'm not that, but it's only an attempt to reinvent the way we learn Torah. Many fronts, now that we're connected to land, now that we have a confidence, we don't have to defend ourselves against foreign Gentile influences. It's called Torah Eretz Yisrael. In some ways it's more of a legal shift to always learn sugyos from the view of Eretz Yisrael and how to analyze a sugya based in Eretz Yisrael. It's less dangerous, but it's also limiting of learning. We like to realize that every sugya has endless horizons, and we can't just nail it down to a location, but it's also I think a lot of Israelis don't fully appreciate how meaningful life is for many Jews outside of Israel. And I think a lot of Israelis, I was just interviewed, the Gush Yeshiva has a weekly Torah journal that goes out to all the Talmidim, all the students in the army. And they have a section. Each week they interview a different rabbi. So I was interviewed this week, and I was trying to explain to them that Israelis have this attitude sometimes that, you know, there are a couple of Jews living in Chutz Laretz in small communities, shopping in small little makolets, davening in one or two little shuls, and they're just waiting to come to Israel, and they realize that everything in Israel is ideal, and everything in Chutz Laretz is dark and bleak and meaningless, and we could just turn everyone to an Israeli, and they all come to Israel to become Israeli, and it doesn't reflect reality. People are still living in the Masals, and it's an important, sensitive but complex question, which I'm not discussing right now. Do you still have the right to live in Masels? But obviously people are living in Masels still outside of Eretz Yisrael, and they're leading very meaningful lives and very rich lives of Torah, rich lives of Jewish identity, rich lives of Jewish experience. And just to condescendingly dismiss those lives, just to assume that our job and our function is to Israelize all people who come to America, to Israel. Some people are looking for that. I think for those people, it's an important and a very, very powerful way to transform into what I call a historical Jew. And obviously, Israel is going to be the epicenter, and we feel we've started the process, and some people feel very drawn towards that. I was drawn towards that. I gave up a budding career in America 30 years ago because I really wanted to be a historical Jew, and I really wanted my children to be in the land of history and affiliated with this process, and I was willing to take a personal hit for a family horizon that I thought was important. But not everyone makes that choice. And when you don't make the choice, it doesn't mean you're living an anemic Jewish life. You're living very, very meaningful Jewish lives. So this juxtaposition of Masos to Eretz Yisrael, I think, reminds us of a more balanced and nuanced approach. That it's not as if everything before we enter the land is meaningless. We could have just written the Masos in one pasuk. And the Masos are delineated because they were the pedestal for entering Eretz Yisrael, and pre-48 was the pedestal for 48. And some people are still building meaningful pedestals to advance Jewish history. And for some people, based on the choice they make about their best way to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that's still a meaningful pedestal, because we haven't yet fully experienced the calling when every single Jew must be in Eretz Yisrael and can be in Eretz Yisrael. No holds barred, no exceptions.